This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read a Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mayer Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Nat.
And today we are covering all Stark chapters, Sansa, Eddard, and Bran. And this is our first chapter introduction to Sansa, which caused a lot of the fan base to hate her.
Absolutely. You know, it's not hard to see why, in my opinion.
Hard not to see why, although I think a lot in the last few years, people have been more cognizant of thinking of Sansa's particular position as a woman in that sort of very precarious position. And it's really easy to like Arya for like screw social convention, but honestly, very few of us are like that. So
I think so too. Arya is just very, you know, just wants to be herself, and Sansa plays the game, and no one likes someone who plays the game, right?
Yeah, and that's been the whole theme of the Starks don't play the game, and therefore, by even attempting to play the game, Sansa is being disloyal.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. There's actually a quote here that that I think is very interesting, but we'll get to it when we get to it.
So it begins with Sansa with Septa Mordain. And, you know, she's with her direwolf lady. And the Septa is like, you're a good girl, Sansa. But when it comes to that creature, you're as willful as your sister Arya.
Yeah, it feels like she's trying to get her to not have Lady with her. Well, it feels like Septa Mordain's trying to get Sansa to leave Lady in the kennels or whatever by comparing her to her sister, which I guess she doesn't want to be compared to her sister. It's the worst thing in the world.
And again, it makes sense for Sansa. Like, they're on the road out in the country. Like, there's no reason why she shouldn't have Lady with her in this very specific context.
And Lady's a good girl. Lady doesn't do anything. She's very sweet and delicate.
Yeah, she says she took the piece of bacon as delicate as a queen.
Oh, these chaps is just... This next chapter, I forgot about this. I knew that it, not really like forgot about it, but I knew, I put it in the back of my mind.
Didn't remember the emotional impact. Yeah.
Yeah. It upsets me more than when things happen to people. But anyway, we'll get to it when we get to it. I keep saying that. I keep trying to get ahead of myself. Never mind.
Yeah. And so Sansa's excited because they've been invited to ride in the wheelhouse, aka carriage, with the queen and the princess. And again, in terms of people trying to crap on, you know, Sansa for liking feminine things or whatever, or liking what is socially expected of her to like, it's like, why wouldn't she want or like these things? This is what she's been trained to do.
At the end of the day, what we don't think, even though she's annoying and this book is for grown-ups, we kind of overlook the fact that she's a child. She's an 11-year-old child, you know? And if you're a woman, I think most of us can relate to the fact that, you know, we've all dreamt. I mean, some of us have dreamt of, you know, castles and fairy tales. And it does make sense for her to want that. She's a child. She's an 11-year-old kid.
Yeah, and she understands, and that's just been put, that sort of fantasization has been put in overdrive because it's been official that she's been betrothed to Prince Joffrey.
Oh, the poor child, she doesn't understand. She lives in a fairy land, like fairy tale land, thinks the real world is the same as that, so she romanticizes Joffrey a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, and she says that in a bit here, because she hoped that he would be in the carriage as well. And she says he was all she ever dreamt her prince should be. A 12-year-old kid. It's just... Oh, no.
Yeah, it's... I totally blame Catelyn in terms of... My first reread through Game of Thrones, I saw, okay, Catelyn is a lot meaner in the book than in how she was mm-hmm. portrayed more softly in the show. But I think in this rereading, I'm more cognizant of how much Catelyn others as a verb, the mm-hmm. North, and hasn't fully integrated... fully integrated, like, she's made peace with, like, you know, having a pretty good relationship with Ned, but anything external beyond that, not really. And so I blame mm-hmm. Catelyn for Sansa having this deep romanticization of the South.
Yeah, absolutely. She probably have sat there and told stories about the South and how it was warm and how they had all the pretty flowers. That doesn't grow in the North. And yeah,
but Sansa doesn't even care about the pretty flowers. Arya goes and gets the flowers.
Yeah, she thinks it's disgusting.
Yeah, so she's excused by Septa Mordane, and she finds mm-hmm. Arya on the banks of the Trident, trying to hold Nymeria still while she brush-dried mud from her fur. And, you know, we get the interaction between the two sisters again. They just have totally different sets of ideals, and me just kind of coming on the side of, you know, both Sansa and Arya's worldviews are completely valid.
Yeah, they have different experiences and they want different things in life. So me, for example, I don't like camping, and I don't like going to festivals because you have to camp, and that's something that I don't like, and I like staying in, you know, nice hotels, and you know, I don't stay in hostels or anything like that. So I do sympathize with Sansa when, you know, she's just like, I don't like riding, and, you know, everything's an endless black bog when they were driving around the, the neck, mm-hmm. when they were crossing the neck. So I don't blame her for it, to be honest. But, you know, when you're reading, it is made for you to feel like Sansa is a stuck-up bitch at the end of the day. Even though I completely, like, am on her side, why wouldn't I want to go in the luxury of the carriage with the queen and have, like, tea and cakes?
Mm-hmm.
You know? But, yeah, it's the way that it's been.
Yeah, and I can see both, because I'm all for lemon cakes in a cushy carriage, but at the same time, I did ride horses as a teenager, so I'm like, riding could be fun too. But mm-hmm. What Sansa represents, you know, in terms of this prissy, stuck-up bitch, you know, at a very superficial reading, reminded me of, I had this whole, like again, very minuscule existential crisis about wearing, like, acrylic fake nails.
Mm-hmm.
Because I worried, like, how will I be perceived if I wear these, like, nails, like, super long nails? And, like, will I come across as prissy, or will people not take me seriously? And then finally got mm-hmm. to a point where I'm just like, I do other things. I have analyzed literature in my spare time. Mm-hmm. I'm intellectually engaged, and physically I can hike 6.7 miles in 2.5 hours. So, you know, I can, you know, rough it, you know, when I want to under certain contexts, and therefore there's no one who should be able to say that I'm shallow or whatever for wearing stupid acrylic fake nails.
Yeah, exactly like that. That's perfectly put. I get the same with wearing a full face of makeup. That's why I don't most of the time. In case people perceive me like I'm some sort of vain, stupid girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And again, shows that, like, Arya really knows her history, like, because she knows the geography and, like, she knows exactly what happened in terms of the battles and everything.
Yeah, yeah. She looked at Sansa like she was stupid because she didn't know that that was where Robert fought Rhaegar and smashed his chest in. So, like, his rubies apparently are still in the river. I don't think so. People probably have just been diving for them.
Yeah, I'm sure looters absconded with them years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I thought it was so sweet. I forgot about this. Like, Arya found, like, 36 flowers that she hadn't known before, and she went into the mud of everything to give her dad a little bouquet of flowers.
You know what? That just made me feel so sad. Just reading that bit, it breaks my heart because you forget how close her and her dad actually were, and it's just heartbreaking. She's the sweetest little girl,
and it's just the sense of that Arya's the tomboy. She likes flowers. And she's like, wow, there are 36 different types of flowers, that's kind of sort of a very girlish thing for Arya to do for her father. Like, obviously she was covered in mud afterwards, but the idea of giving her father a thing of flowers, like, that's very feminine.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. She picked them up just because they were pretty. So it's not like she was interested in them in a scientific, I guess,
medieval.
How scientific can you get in the in medieval? But yeah, she just thought that they were pretty, and she picked them up and gave them to her dad. You know, and obviously it didn't turn out very well.
Yeah, one of them gave her a rash.
Yeah, but she just laughed it off, and Sansa is just really mean. She was like, and she rubbed mud all over her arms like some ignorant bog woman. It's just honestly. Yeah,
And Sansa is very more cognizant and a participant in societal structures, because she looks down on Arya for talking to anyone and, like, socializing with anyone.
Yeah. Now, do you think that Arya would have made a better leader? So, not that I want Arya to to have been engaged to Joffrey at all, or betrothed to Joffrey, but, you know, in this context, I think Arya would have been a better future queen, just because she talks to everyone regardless of her status.
I think both Sansa and Arya are on opposite extremes, where neither of them are a good candidate of being like a sort of queen in this context. Like, they're both bad in different ways, like, which is reason for good portion of the book I am Team Renly, because Team Renly kind of balances, you know, that talking to the common folk and but also being smarter than Ned and being able to accept the shitty world that he lives in and dealing with it. So
yeah he plays the game perfectly.
And it was very sad when he died.
Yeah. so a bit here as well. So, you know, Arya keeps saying that she doesn't want to go, and she says, I don't like the queen, even though, like, you know, Sansa's just like, you know, let's go, there's going to be tea and lemon cakes, which is something that Sansa likes. It's not even Arya's thing. And Arya's like, no, I don't like the queen. She won't even let me bring Nymeria. And then this is what I wanted to mention before, is that she says, a royal wheelhouse is no place for a wolf. So I feel like she's turning her back on her family and her heritage in order to fit in with the royal household.
Yeah. And Princess Marcella is afraid of them. You know that. Marcella is a little baby.
I love that.
Yeah. Although, yeah, I feel very sympathetic for Marcella again going forward in Dance of Dragons and other things. But we'll get to that later.
Yeah.
So Sansa's basically, you know, commenting on how much Nymeria is like Arya in being unruly and things like that.
Yeah. Well, the wolves act exactly like them. You know, Nymeria is just like full of mud and doesn't want to be brushed and just wants to run away. And Lady is just sat by Sansa, very well behaved, and, you know, just observing everything. And I feel like they pick up a lot of their emotions and they replicate it.
Yeah. Why couldn't Arya be sweet and delicate and kind like Princess Marcella? She would have liked a sister like that.
Yeah. It's again thinking that everything's like a fairy tale, you know, In the perfect world, she would be, you know, she'll be all ladylike, and there will be very, you know, very good friends who'd be giggling to the side and gossiping and, you know, it's... but it's not that. And you know what? I think she's really mean to Arya, because she says, you know, that she wondered, she says that it would have been easier if Arya was a bastard like Jon, and because they even look alike. And she is othering, again, she's othering the Starks, and just like her mom does, exactly like her mom does. And, you know, her wishing that Arya was a bastard is just like so that she could distance herself and not be linked to someone like her, you know, who's not ladylike, who's not a lady.
Yeah. So we've got Sansa leaves Arya and comes across, you know, certain members of the Kingsguard has joined the entourage, where we get Barristan Selmy.
Yeah, so I guess that they are close to close to King's Landing now. So they came to meet, and Barristan Selmy, quite an older man, but he's the captain of the Kingsguard. Is that what it's called? The captain, Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, and Renly is there as well.
Renly's there, and then Sir Illyn Payne, which it took me a moment to realize ill and in pain.
That is true, because he does. Oh my god! You know what? You're so smart. I was just here like.
I can't take credit for that. That was Natasha from Unspoiled who pointed that out.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, she's very smart. But he does look very ill and in pain. I mean, he should be, because he doesn't have a tongue.
Yeah, and Sansa is really, you know, taken aback by him, and then bumps into the Hound, which I'm just going to put up, you know, obviously Sansa's a child and, you know, you have to think about all these things. But, you know, in a perfect world, I'm a big Sansa Sandor shipper.
I don't know about that. I don't ship Sansa with anyone. I think the way that, you know, the TV show ended is perfect for her. Mm-hmm. She doesn't need anyone. Spoilers! in case people haven't seen the TV show, the end of the TV show.
Again, she has a lot of blind spots naturally because of all this romanticization and fantasization, but we do start to see glimmers of her feeling like, you know, like the Hound is really fearsome, but this quiet sort of subtlety of Illyn Payne is definitely worse and more dangerous and more ominous and insidious.
Yeah. Yeah, she definitely senses that there's something incredibly, incredibly wrong with him. And she senses that something is going to happen. By the way that, you know, she describes him, she says, you know, as a terror as overwhelming as anything Sansa Stark has ever felt when she looks at him. And, I think that's definitely like that sixth sense that kicks in, like something is not right here. And why would she be so frightened of this old man when there's like the Hound there just behind her with like half of his face scarred and burnt off. And, you know, he doesn't scare her as much as Illyn Payne does. So I think it's definitely, an omen of some sort.
Yeah. And what was I going to say? Oh, I know. I was going to say, you know, the interesting thing, like, we just don't get enough of, you know, background or context with Illyn Payne to know what's going on in his head. But I wonder if it's kind of like, I don't know if I remember where I read this, but just the idea that in certain contexts in history, like, they purposely sought out people who, again, were, like, you know, mentally disabled in some way, whether Down syndrome or something else, so that because once they were in that position of being like an executioner or a torturer, like not fully cognitively understanding like the implications or not having the same empathy that would for than someone who was in full control of their mental faculties.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that does make sense. Him being a bit, you know, a bit terrifying. And I feel like Cersei just keeps bringing in the point like she ensures that the message is clear to anyone, but especially the Starks, that Ilyn Payne is there to carry the king's justice. So people better not step out of line, otherwise he steps in, you mm-hmm. know? So she emphasizes that twice, that point twice, in a matter mm-hmm. of like minutes.
Some guards start to turn on Lady, and I love mm-hmm. how the Hound is like, the Starks use them as wet nurses.
You know what? The Hound has some of the best lines, you know, he doesn't give a shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't necessarily call it shade, because shade implies some subtlety and passive aggression, which that's just not the Hound style. But yeah, he's got a few good one-liners.
He's just very much like, this is what I am. I don't give a shit what you think of me. I'll say what I want to say.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I made the point of Joffrey doesn't do anything in regards to Sansa until his mother mm-hmm. tells him to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is,
his mother tells him, go to Sansa, and then he pretends to like berate people, and then she says, oh, he saved me, because again, in her head, she's, you know, idolizing him and putting him on this pedestal, which he's not. He's a 12-year-old nasty kid.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, again, I'm not that I blame Sansa for not picking up on this subtlety at, you know, 11 or 12 years old, but yeah, and so it's the same where the mother, Cersei, tells Joffrey to go to her, and then also tells her, you know, Joffrey, go spend the day with Sansa, because we have to postpone our little wheelhouse mm-hmm. get-together.
Do you think she did it on purpose?
I'm not sure, actually. Did she give a reason for why it was postponed? Like, they have to talk about business or whatever?
Yeah, they had, now that Barristan Selmy and Renly were there, they needed to talk, well, she needed to entertain them until Robert came back from the hunt.
Oh, okay. I don't know, it could be anything, but, so, and it's just funny, like, the whole day that's described with Sansa and Joffrey, and it's like, oh, I love writing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, totally, again, I don't want to see it as Sansa being like two-faced or lying, but you know, she's just experimenting with what she likes, and it's just really sad that all the things that, you know, she says she enjoyed this day in terms of riding and being able to see the countryside, mm-hmm. she could have done that as easily and was offered that with Arya.
Yeah. Yeah, but she doesn't want to hang out with Arya, because apparently Arya spoils everything, and you know, Arya is this, and Arya is that, and Arya is the worst thing that has happened to her. It's sad. Also, going back to the point where she says, you know, that Joffrey saved her from the Hound and Sir Ailyn Payne, and it's like, she doesn't see that, well, that he hasn't done anything, but also that it was her charm and the things that she had learned from, you know, her charm school with
etiquette
her mother
school.
And yeah with her mother and Septa Mordane, that got her out of that embarrassment that she was feeling, and it had nothing to do with Joffrey. So we start to see here, you know, how she uses her strengths to get out of situations, but she doesn't realize yet. She doesn't
like
realize
many women
that
like many women in this world were yeah. told not. Like, all the things that are involved in emotional labor and a lot of invisible stuff that women just are naturally socially conditioned to do, and we don't mm-hmm. even acknowledge it. And now there's lots of brouhaha in workplaces because women are starting to now put labels on, this is all the shit I do for you people, and you mm-hmm. don't do anything. Like, it doesn't translate into money or other forms of compensation. Screw this.
Yeah. It's great. I feel like we are in a pendulum now that is swinging towards women raising their voices more in regards mm-hmm. to rights and rights at work as well as socially. So we'll get there, ladies. We'll get there.
We shall. So they have, again, I just wish we could have seen more of direct dialogue between Sansa and Joffrey, because that could be more telling in terms of, again, the sort of ethics and, you know, being able to more more assuredly come on the anti or pro Sansa in light of all the big incident that happens. But we don't get any sort of that dynamic of, again, she's still a kid, but being able to see between Joffrey and Sansa, being able to like properly evaluate, okay, how much of this is like there are glaring red flags and she's ignoring them, or how much of this is really still very subtle.
But I think that it was done purposefully because it didn't have much of a... I don't think they had much to talk about. I think they just rode around and, again, she was romanticizing everything and that whole situation. And she's like, oh, I'm with my prince, my gallant and handsome prince. So brave, this 12-year-old little kid. So brave. You know, so yeah, I don't think, I think that was deliberate that we didn't see any dialogue between them because there was nothing going on. She was just, you know, in her head and like, oh, everything is so beautiful here with my prince. And, you know, and that's what it was. Nothing went on. And then she was just like, oh, he was so gallant because he asked for food for his lady.
Alrighty then. And so we get to the dreaded incident where Joffrey and Sansa come upon Arya and Micah sparring together with their sticks.
Yeah. You know, he's just a curious person. And, well, because they were both a bit tipsy, I think that the drink has made his farce, like, fake gallantry just drop off completely. She was saying, oh, let's go back. And he's just like, no. You know, so he was just already dismissing her, which he wouldn't be doing otherwise. And he just went up to them and, you know, showed his true self, which is a lovely, lovely boy.
Yes, lovely. And Joffrey, again, trying to basically cloak it in this, you attacked a highborn lady, when it's so obvious and just...
He's trying to find an excuse to fight and to hurt this common boy, because obviously he can't do it to Arya, so he has to do it with, you know, to this kid who's, you know, lowborn, you know, son of the butcher's kid. And
yep, and so he starts to draw blood on Micah's cheek. It's just
it was a nasty little shit.
It's so gross in terms of, again, whether he's just like a quote-unquote normal psychopath or is this incestuous stuff, neurological things going on. But yeah, it's just really disgusting and creepy. And he's just so used to getting his way and no one intervening that he's in shock when Arya just pops him on the head with the stick from behind.
I love her. I love her. She doesn't give a crap about who he is, where he comes from. He's searching her friends, so she goes and, like, completely fucks him up.
Yeah, and then Sansa's screaming, stop it, you're spoiling it.
Yeah, yeah.
Are they spoiling?
Yeah, it's spoiling the fantasy that everything is amazing, that everything's a fairy tale, and she's a pretty princess who's going to marry this pretty prince, and they're going to become king and queen. You know, they're spoiling that fantasy.
And then...
Well, and then Nymeria comes to attack him. Because he backs Arya into a tree with his sword. And then instead of, like, Sansa going, can you stop? You know, this is my sister. She just, like, stands back and lets him advance towards his sister with a real sword. And then Nymeria comes and, like, bites his arm and he drops the sword.
Yeah. And I give Arya chops for, in that situation, not just running away, just being able to deciding to throw the sword into the river.
Yeah. Oh, before that, oh my god, I just thought, like, the switcheroo that she did, right, with the sword, like, Nymeria grabs his arm, so he lets go of the sword. So she was being backed up, right, against a tree. No escape, the Nymeria came, like, bit his arm, drops the sword, so she takes the sword and then advances towards him, right? And he's all threatened and he's crying. He's like, please don't hurt me, right? That is what the switcheroo situation, that she takes the sword, is exactly like the battle, season 8. Go watch it. I love it. I don't think it's right. I don't think that battle was right about what happened, but it was an amazing scene. Anyway. Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, she throws Lion Tooth in the river, runs away with Micah and Narmeria, and Sansa tries to approach Joffrey and comfort him. And she's like, I'll go get help. And then his eyes snapped open and looked at her, and there was nothing but loathing there, nothing but the vilest contempt. Then go, he spit at her, and don't touch me.
Yeah, yeah, the fart has completely dropped now that he's hurt, drunk, doesn't care. Very much like his dad, when we see later on that he used to have to drink and get in bed with Cersei. Mm-hmm. And then all the farts would come off. The thing that bothers me a lot about this chapter, you know, it's very hefty, and I think that that's how it's going to go from here on out. But what bothers me is all the, is the farce that happens, like Sansa, you know, with the knights and being like, you know, trying to pretend that she's not that scared, and it's all like playing, she's playing the game, but it still really bothers me because she's not authentic. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then there's Cersei. Cersei will always bother me. You know, please give your sweet sister my apologies because, you know, they had to cancel the ride. And she doesn't think Arya is sweet. She doesn't think any of them are sweet. And then there's Joffrey as well, just acting all gallant and chivalrous when he actually isn't. I don't know. I have a lot of problems with people being fake. And yeah, that chapter really triggered me.
Yeah, because it's the sense of, and Sansa will go through this transformation of, is she playing the game in terms of in a delusional fantasy way, or playing the game purely out of self-preservation? But yeah, it's, yeah, Sansa and her, again, willful, and you know, a lot of comparisons have been made in terms of, you know, like, abusive relationships, and you know, how much of it is just, you know, how much can you put on a woman, or whichever, male or woman, the, you know, abused party to read these sort of signals, or even be able to act upon these signals when there is a deep power imbalance and things like that.
Yeah
But then we move on to Eddard. So we've got Eddard, and they found her, and I forgot about this, that basically Arya was missing for 4 days.
Yeah, yeah, that's completely lost.
That was horrifying for a parent.
Yeah, yeah, especially because it's nowhere near where they live. So where was she? Obviously, you're completely worried. It's like a different, it's basically a new country. So someone who hasn't left Winterfell all her life. It's insane to think. I would have just thought that she'd be dead.
Yeah.
If it was me.
Yeah, so but Arya is eventually found, and Ned is super pissed that she was brought before, like, the king and queen, before she was brought to him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Especially because Robert is his friend. So, you know, Robert, if she got brought in front of him, he would have said, did this girl got seen by her dad? Let's just, you know, it already shows the cracks in their friendship right there.
Yeah, the cracks in, yep, it is definitely the cracks in their friendship. And so, you know, Arya is crying, and basically what's been told to the king and queen by little shit Joffrey is that Arya and the butcher's boy, you know, began an unprovoked attack on Joffrey, beating him with clubs and then sicking Nymeria on them. With no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, yeah. Which is bit pathetic for him to say that. That is just like, yeah, either way, he doesn't look good, but he likes to be seen as the victim, which is very pathetic. Another thing as well that I notice here, so when Ned goes to Arya, it describes here that he can't find a friendly face amongst everyone who was there, which means, like, so he lists bannermen who are there, and Lord Renly and Barrister Selmy, he listed them as some sort of like sort of friendly faces, but he doesn't list Robert as a friendly face.
No, he doesn't. And you know, when Arya's saying that's not true and like calling Joffrey a liar, like I got really triggered by this scene in a way that I didn't in the first read, because I was just, my first read was purely like analytical, like how exactly the same or different it is compared to the show. But readdressing it, I got super triggered because Joffrey reminded me so much of my husband's ex-girlfriend. Because she was all about this smear campaign to discredit my husband to the point of alleging domestic abuse. And again, just being incensed that someone has the audacity to say something that outrageous that isn't true.
Yeah. And it's the play on the power because, you know, and rightly so, we are saying, you know, believe women. So she abuses that power that she has as a woman to accuse him of something so horrible. And then on this, Joffrey is using his power as a prince to lie about the situation.
Yeah. And in my real life situation, it was combination and then also the fact that she was a white woman saying it against a...
There you go. Yeah.
A Middle Eastern man.
Yeah.
So that was a factor, certainly. And so, yeah, just getting really triggered by Joffrey. And I'm like, oh my god, I hate this little piece of shit.
That's when you start to really, really, really dislike him. And then, you know, Ned thought that by bringing Sansa in, it would back Arya's story because he had heard it. He heard it before. Sansa told him before. So he's like, well, I'm going to discredit this kid because... he's not telling the truth, and Sansa knows, except that Sansa comes in and doesn't want to agree either way. She doesn't want to rock the boat.
Yeah, and I forgot about that Eddard states that Sansa, like, told him what happened, like, previously. I don't know, maybe it was in my brain that she just wasn't telling, like, anyone, because she was, like, still in denial about, you know, Joffrey and things like that. But she did tell her dad what happened. So, and yeah, so that makes it look even worse for her when she when they finally pull her in to give her testimony. And she's just like, I don't know, she said tearfully, looking as though she wanted to bolt. I don't remember, everything happened so fast, I didn't see. And then, you know, Arya screaming, liar, liar, liar.
And yeah, you're rotten. And then she jumps on her and like knocks her to the ground and starts pounding on her. Ned's just like, what has gotten into you? You're a wild child.
And so I was also triggered by that because Sansa, you know, it's easy to shit on Sansa for, you know, telling one story to Ned and not being able to say it in front of everyone else. But I remember when I had to go in court and appear before a judge to explain my concern about my husband's crazy ex-girlfriend, because we were wanting a restraining order. And his girlfriend was there, and so was her lawyer. And I, anytime I even tried to give my side of the story, which obviously did not paint his ex-girlfriend in a positive light, like, her lawyer would constantly say object because he thought he didn't like my wording of things. So it got to a point where, like, I kind of really stopped talking, not because I didn't want to, not that I didn't want to help my husband or that I didn't have information to give, but I just realized, like, this is not, you know, like, Sansa is smart enough to realize, like, this is not a safe environment to be able to tell the truth and, you know, and the complicated nuances of that truth.
Yeah. She's playing the game, which is what she has to do. You know, at the end of the day, she is betrothed to Joffrey. She's stuck between her duty and her family.
And again, that's a lot to be put on. And again, I don't think Eddard should be necessarily, you know, mad at Sansa because he put her in the situation of being betrothed to Joffrey anyway. And this is an inevitable consequence of that.
Yeah. At the end of the day, you do have to be you know, on your betrothed's side, and you can see that she didn't want. When you look at it at this, you know, in this light, she wanted to help her sister, but then she didn't want to, you know, be in that position where.
Yeah. So yeah, like once you're in that sort of like public room again, trying to tell your side of the story, and you know, and again, not Sansa wanting to be. Again, not wanting to be, like, cognitively wanting to, like, screw over Arya or anyone anyone else. She just, you know, again, like, when I was in that courtroom, I'm just like, this is not a safe place to be able to tell the truth. And so, you know, again, her just even, she's, even she, probably Sansa in her mind, thinks she's doing her best by not even affirming Joffrey's side. She's just, I don't know, I didn't see it all happen so fast. So she's not giving anything, like, in her mind, in this very limited, really intimidating situation, she feels like she's being, you know, being loyal to her family, probably because she's just not full on board confirming Joffrey's side of things.
Yeah. And then, well, then Cersei tells Robert that he wants Arya punished because she's clearly unbalanced, but, you know, attacking her sister. And he says she's completely out of control. And then... and then he tells her that she's just a child, that he's not going to punish her because she's just a child, which is curious because he considers Arya just a child, but then he just wants to kill Dany. He wants to kill Dany, right?
Yeah.
And Dany is just a child too.
Well,
because it's the enemy.
Well, again, in his mind, you know, Targaryens are inhuman, are subhuman at this point. So, and then, yeah, like, he's like, Cersei, look at her, she's a child. What would you have me do, whip her through the streets?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah. Damn it. Children fight. It's over. No lasting harm was done. And the queen was furious. Joffrey will carry these scars for the rest of his life. And Robert looked at his eldest son. So he will. Perhaps that will teach him a lesson. I think it's very much... not even Robert honestly believing. I think Robert is smart enough to realize that Joffrey is a little shit.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just either just purely not caring, not wanting to deal with it, not wanting to deal with Cersei nagging at him, or feeling he has to save face in terms of being the king and naturally standing behind, like, what his own son says happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's saving face, to be honest. He's saving face. He's not going to turn his back on his family, even though he absolutely hates them.
Yep. And so they want Nymeria killed, but Nymeria is gone. And Cersei's like, we have a wolf. And again, it's very hard for me to step into this sort of medieval collectivist thinking where it's just, even though it wasn't the wolf in question, we just need a wolf as a sort of payment for this transgression. Again, coming from a modern standpoint, it's very hard to step in where this sort of thing is logical.
Yeah, I think she was thinking more of the, like, because you know how sneaky Cersei is, and I think she was thinking more on the side of it's punishment for the Starks, it's punishment for them, you know, it's punishment for, I guess, Sansa for not sticking to Joffrey's side as well. So it's punishment for them. Like, so there's no wolf. There's no Nymeria then.
Yeah.
You know, the other one.
Yeah, I totally understand Cersei's motivation in terms of wanting something as a general punishment of the Starks. But in terms of everyone else around them, you know, accepting this sort of collectivist that, yes, that's appropriate.
Yeah, it's very weird. It's a very weird train of thought.
Like in... back in the 90s when Draco Malfoy was attacked by Buckbeak, it's not a situation of if Buckbeak had ran away, which he did, that another hippogriff that Hagrid had to be killed in its place. That of course would never be a thing or an option.
Yeah, they didn't kill any other hippogriff.
To compensate for that, like, you know, Lucius Malfoy didn't need or didn't expect that. But yeah, it's just very interesting. That just sort of old school collectivist way of thinking, and it's very hard to wrap my head around it in this way.
The part that makes me chuckle, he says, you know, I want no part. Robert tells Cersei when she says, you know, that you know, 100 golden dragons to the man who brings me the wolf skin, well, Nymeria's skin, and then he says, and then Robert says to her, I want no part of this woman. You can damn well buy your first with Lannister gold. And then she says to him, the king I thought to wed would have laid the wolf skin across my bed before the sun went down. And he says to her, that would be a fine trick without a wolf.
Yeah, it's... Again, well, Cersei is trying to play to his sort of humiliating him or emasculating him to trying to get him to do what he wants, and it's not working.
Yeah, he just, like, doesn't give a shit. But then when she says, you know, there is another wolf, that he's like, yeah, whatever. Just have Cyril and Payne, you know, come and decapitate, you know, the dog. The dire wolf, and then Ned just steps in and he's like, you can't do this. Like, you know that this is completely stupid. And then he says to Ned, which is interesting as well, a dire wolf is a savage beast. Sooner or later, it would have turned on your girl the same way it did on my son. I don't know. I always look at it, you know, with more of a meaning. And it's kind of like, does he actually really trust Ned? Does he trust Ned as much as
he says,
like, Ned trusts him? Yeah.
Yeah. And also it's the sense of, I read into it, what we got here. Would have turned on your girl the same way the other did on my son. Get her a dog. She'll be happier for it. Get her a dog. Sandor Clegane.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And then so, there's a bit where it says here, Arya goes to actually Sansa's and Lady's defense. She says, Lady wasn't there, you leave her alone. Even though Sansa didn't stand up for her, she's standing up for her sister as well. Mm-hmm. Because, like her dad, she can't play the game.
Yeah, she cannot play the game. And again, sees Lady as separate from Sansa and doesn't see everything in a whole weird collectivist enmeshed entity.
Yeah.
And... you know, please, Robert, for the love you bear me, for the love you bore my sister, please. And the king looked at them for a long moment, then turned his eyes on his wife. Damn you, Cersei, he said with loathing.
It seems here that, you know, even though Robert is reluctant, his loyalties still lie with his family, which is a stark contrast between Robert and Ned. Like, Ned's loyalties lie with Robert. So much so that he left his wife, left his sick kid behind to follow Robert.
Mm-hmm.
But Robert is not even granting him the same courtesy.
Indeed, he's sticking with it. And it's, again, it's this weird thing where Robert said he wanted Ned because Ned wasn't like Southerners. But he should have been smart enough to realize if you bring in someone like Ned, he's gonna naturally bring that northern political culture, and now he's bringing it and you don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, he just doesn't want to hear it. And that's, I think, like, him and Robert got on very well when they were younger, and when they're when they aligned with each other, their thoughts and their morals aligned. But Robert has been in the south for way too long. And Ned has been in the north for way too long that they're not the same people anymore. And Ned basically calls him a coward. You know, he says, at least have the courage to do it yourself, to kill Lady herself. Kill Lady himself instead of getting a limp pain. He just completely ignores Ned and walks away.
Yeah. And then Ned goes to Lady and it's so sad.
Yeah. Yeah, so he decides that he's going to do it himself because, you know, she is from the north and she is a Stark, so he's going to do it herself. And I can't read it again. Read it again. Like, my heart just hurts. I actually feel like crying again, just thinking of it. It's just awful because the way that he describes her, I can't do it. Can't do it.
Okay, when it's over, you know, we get the little interaction between Sandor has run down Micah.
Yeah, yeah. And he just, like, slashed him from what, like...
shoulder to waist.
Yeah.
Just really gross. And it's like he ran, but not very fast.
And he laughed about it as well.
Yeah. And thus ends Eddard's chapter.
Very depressing.
Very depressing indeed. And then we move on to a very short chapter of Bran.
Yeah, don't have many notes on that. It's just a lot of dreams. I'm not very good at interpreted dreams, but I think this is very very self-explanatory, really.
Of course, yeah. And even if you don't believe in sort of dreams have some super magical meaning, at the core, a lot of dreams have a psychological component of where you can engage interpretation of what is this representing any sort of anxieties or things in my real life.
Yeah. Like when I have really bad anxiety, which is most of the time, but I dream that my teeth are falling or that I can't brake my car. I'm driving and the brakes don't work.
Oh, I've never had the car brake dream, but the biggest anxiety dream I have is my teeth rotting and falling out.
Mm-hmm. It's awful, isn't it? It's just It's horrible. Or when I have one where my leg is shorter than the other, and they're so vivid. They're so vivid that I wake up and I actually think that.
Yeah. Yeah, and of course the flying dream is very common, but I tend to have more swimming, like mermaid dreams, than flying. Mm-hmm. And then even if it is flying, like the way I'm flying is like being a mermaid, like swimming in the air.
Oh, I want to have that dream. I've never had a dream that I was a mermaid. I've always wanted to be a mermaid. I'm so jealous.
I'm very tempted to blow like $300 on an actual mermaid tail.
Yeah. I wanted to do that. I used to watch The Little Mermaid and wrap like a throw that my grandmother had around my legs and just sit on the arm of the sofa and pretend that I was a mermaid.
Yeah. Again, because I've got a lake that I'm just next door to. I could be the lady of the lake.
Yes. You could just sit on a rock and brush your hair with your mermaid tail.
Yes. But Bran is not a mermaid. Bran is falling. Mm.
Yeah, yeah. And he just thinks it's a normal falling dream, like we all have those, you know?
Yeah.
Before we get to the bottom, we wake up. And mm-hmm. He just keeps falling and falling and falling.
Yep, and there's a very annoying crow saying, "Don't cry, fly."
He's really annoying. Yeah. He's just like, you know, just fly. And he's like, I can't, I don't have any feathers. And he's like, just flap your arms.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, there are different kinds of wings, the crow said.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so he's just falling and falling. And then we get the sort of, you know, Bran actually sees in present real time what's going on in the north, mm-hmm. south, east, west. And we get to the south and, you know, he sees his mother sitting alone, you know, on the road trying to get to King's Landing.
I think, I actually think they were on the boat. Because I think someone was throwing up on the side of the boat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because they're trying, they got to get to at least to White Harbor.
Yeah, yeah. So they were on the boat. And then he, you know, he sees, you know, Ned and the girls in the south and the girls are crying. And he sees John at the wall and he's very cold and shivering while he's trying to sleep. And then he goes beyond the wall. And what he sees beyond the wall terrifies him.
Yeah,
and he starts to cry.
Yep, and then there's one particular like sun and stars, so it made me think Khal Drogo.
Oh yes, yes. Oh, I didn't think about that.
Yeah, and then you know, just this whole thing. Sort of, I don't know if George R. R. Martin did a great deal of research, but there are kind of, you know, very trippy things that people said they've seen when they've had a near death experience. You know, like. You know, like that, where, you know, whether it's seeing the light or, having the near-death experience, like, again, manifested itself in some other way.
Yeah. Oh, before we get to Beyond the Wall, actually, so, you know, he saw, there's a bit that says he saw clear across the narrow sea to the free cities and the green Dothraki Sea and beyond. And then there's a bit that he says to Ashai. Yeah. By the shadow where dragons stirred beneath the surface. So it's not like where that dragons... I read it in the present time, where dragons stirred, not like where dragons used to stir. I don't know.
No,
does that make sense?
Yeah, because everything else that he's describing is real time, present time.
Mm-hmm.
So yay, maybe more dragons. That would be so fun. And then I naturally thought of the Dumbledore's quote in Deathly Hallows. Of course it's happening in your head, Harry. But why should that make it any less real?
Yes, that crow, raven, whatever it is, it should be called Dumbledore. There always has to be a wise old man that just tells you cryptic things that you think, shit, that actually makes sense.
Yep. And then Bran finally decides to fly, and the raven is pecking at his forehead, which we now know opened the third eye.
Yeah, yeah. Opening his third eye so he can see, and then you know, he wakes up, and he sees his direwolf laying across his leg, and then the girl who was there just, like, screamed. She's like, what the fuck? And then, like, runs off saying that he was awake. And and yeah, so his direwolf slain or his across his legs, but he can't feel anything. He tried to move, he tried to get up, and he just can't do it because he can't feel anything.
Yeah, and Rob burst in, so breathless from his dash up the tower steps. The direwolf was licking Bran's face. Bran looked up calmly. His name is Summer, he said.
Yeah. What do you think the meaning of the name is?
I think it's just a testament to how Bran's story moving forward is so tied with the going beyond the wall and the north and all the White Walkers and all the problems going on there, and, you know, fighting that and trying to be a instrument in, you know, defending the world from that, so that the opposite of the winter and the long night is, of course, summer.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I put down. I put, you know, because the crow said winter is coming, and winter is coming, and summer is hope.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the dire wolves. I love them. I wish I had one.
Did it get to a point in the books where Summer died?
I don't remember.
Yeah, because that was really sad.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get to that point. I think he has. I think he has, but I'm not sure.
Boo.
Yeah. But when we get to that point, I will talk a little bit more about my theories of the direwolves.
Oh. Alrighty then. And now we move on to history lessons. So my history lesson comes from Sansa and Arya, and just that whole very tenuous sister relationship. Do you know what that reminded me of? It reminded me of Charlotte and Anne Bronte.
Oh, I thought it was going to be Anne Boleyn and her sister.
Yeah, I thought about that, but that is definitely very much a creative license taken substantially. So I don't know how much of that is really true. So, but I know the Charlotte and the jealousy between Charlotte and Bronte is very well established, to the point that when Anne died or right before her death, basically Charlotte Bronte was a little bit petty and prevented Anne Bronte's most famous novel now, The Tenant of Wildfell Hall, from being published with, like, the other two novels that of Charlotte and Emily. And to this day, Anne Bronte is not as well known as, of course, Charlotte and Emily. And, you know, so that, like, only kind of now, like, near 200 years later, is Anne Bronte, like, starting to be, like, brought back to the, you know, into the fold, and being given the same status as our sisters. So so let me read a little. It may sound outrageous today, given the supremacy of Charlotte's reputation over Anne's, but Charlotte was also jealous of Anne's writing. The first publication from the Bronte sisters was poems by Currer Ellis and Acton Bell, a joint collection of verse that they paid to have published. While Amy is undoubtedly the best poet among the three, Anne's verse is too, is far superior to Charlotte's, which is often labored and overly long. Despite poor sales, they were bioadapters seeing writing print and decided upon a plan to publish three novels jointly. And Agnes Gray found a publisher alongside Emily's Wuthering Heights, but alas, Charlotte's contribution, The Professor, was rejected by all who saw it. Without intending any malice, the litter sister had triumphed over the older again. To Charlotte, it must have seemed insufferable. So yeah, so very much it's described as Charlotte Bronte being very waspish, and because she was the oldest, so she saw like her mother die and her older sisters died when Anne was still younger and didn't fully understand all those things. And so in many ways I see Charlotte Bronte being a sort of like Arya like figure, and then Anne being a much more quiet, you know, demeanor, more like Sansa. But yeah, like the fact that these two sisters are really, really different. And it, again, it's debated whether their rivalry, like if their relationship itself was super tenuous, or was this all just purely what Charlotte was thinking and she like, you know, repressed it and again, acted out in terms of not trying to get Anne's, you know, magnum opus published. But yeah, just showed two sisters who just had very different approaches to life and trying to exist in the same writing sphere, and you know, just all the complications that go with that.
Yeah, I think that relationships with between sisters, I don't have a sister, but from what I observed, that relationships between sisters are either you're just so close to each other, or you absolutely hate each other, and I don't think there's something in between. My mom and her sister were just completely, just absolutely hated each other. Where they would get into like fights, you know, about just petty things about like clothes and, you know, borrowing clothes and going out. And yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting, the relationship between two women who are related. They go from two extremes.
Yep. So what was your history lesson?
So my history lesson is perhaps because there's a lot of like direwolf heavy content in these three chapters. So it's talking about the inspiration, I guess, what might have been the inspiration between the direwolves and their resemblance to their owners, so their sort of human traits. And so their behavior might come from Celtic legend in folklore. I'm gonna completely butcher this, so I'm so sorry. It's called it's a thing called a folad or conroich, which are called shapeshifters. So you know, they believe that there were werewolves who were called on by ancient kings to help in battles. It's curious because direwolves appear on the wisp of a war. So these direwolves begin, you know, appear in the beginning of this story when we're months or just like a year away from all hell breaking loose. So I think that that's very curious. So ghosts as well mirrors the Celtic myths that white animals are from the other world. And it's probably why the other direwolves have felt uneasy when they were near him, and people feel uneasy when they were near him, and why he's so quiet and brooding. And, you know, so yeah, not very long, but that's my sort of theory for the direwolves.
Nice. You need to work on your Gaelic, as they call it.
I know. I do. I do. It's really bad, and I should. I should try.
Alrighty then. And now we move on to friendship lessons. So my friendship lesson comes from Sansa, like another don't do, obviously not directly condemning Sansa in the sense, because again, it's not just we're not purely dealing with friendships, we're dealing with political engagements and all sorts of other crap going on. But what I gleaned from this in terms of the way she's fantasizing Joffrey to a degree, and again, seeing the worst in her sister, but don't deprioritize your friends for a new relationship.
Absolutely. Because
I have been guilty of this in a few times in dating where I like blew off friends, where it's like, yeah, of course you want to, you know, a new relationship is exciting, but you also shouldn't be like, you know, completely drop off the grid in terms of your normal social circle.
Yeah, it is. I think it is normal in the beginning to do it, but you always need to think, you know, you always need to bring yourself back. You know, because they have been, you know, your friends have been there for you before this person came on. And regardless if this person will be your future husband or not, they will still be there. So, yeah.
So what was yours?
So mine is going back to, you know, the fight when Joffrey came through and he saw Micah and Arya play fighting, and he just caused a whole crapoli full of things. And Arya went to defend Micah, you know, hit him. And it's like, always back your friends in situations where they are in harm's way. And that can be harm's way as in like a situation that they are uncomfortable in. So always back them up and just be a friend.
Yeah, because
don't let injustices happen.
Yeah, because I may be coming across as an apologist in regards to Sansa, because I'm trying to be cognizant of all the sort of issues with feminism and, you know, the lack of power women have traditionally have, where playing the game has a lot of times has been women's only recourse to gain even a little bit of power. But yeah, the fact that Sansa, like, shit starts to get very real very quickly, and that doesn't break the facade, or that doesn't break the fantasy window.
Yeah, she still chooses to be on his side, and even when Arya backs him up, but you know, backs him to a tree like with the sword, she shouts at Arya and says leave him alone. So she's not backing her sister, her friend, you know, the way that Arya, you know, backed her when, you know, they said, oh, we're gonna get Lymeria and kill her. And the way that Arya backed Micah. So be like Arya, basically. Be like Arya.
Yes, be like Arya, because there's no situation, or shouldn't be a really dire situation where playing the game, because you need to literally survive, like in most modern contexts, at least in the developing world, that should not be a thing.
Yeah.
And thus concludes this episode of Podcaster's Landing. Tune in next time where we get your favorite character, Catelyn, John.
For God's sake.
And John, your real favorite afterwards.
Yeah.
And then Eddard again.
Great. Yep. I just don't really want to read about Catelyn again. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it. And we're just in the beginning as well. There's a lot more Catelyn chapters to go.
Yeah, I'm looking at my edition, illustrated edition of Storm of Swords. It's like the thickest.
Can we just skip? Can we just give an overview and a skip?
Sadly, no, we cannot. Although I'm gonna have to discipline myself, because I did skip over some Theon chapters because I found him so disagreeable, but I will I'm preventing myself from doing that. But
yeah, if I have to read about Catelyn, you have to read about Theon, okay?
Yes, exactly. Alrighty then, catch you guys later for Catelyn, John, and Eddard. Bye! Thank you for listening to Podcaster's Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian-German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMareStudios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. that was the Sophia Mayer Studios podcast.